Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
The following is a presentation of Second City Works, delivered by your earbuds at WGN Plus.
Welcome to the Second City Works Getting to Yes And. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Improvisation at the world-famous Second City Theater. This podcast is about navigating work and life without a script. Improvisation is a practice in collaborating more effectively, tapping into your full creative potential, and building ensembles who can both support and challenge us. If you like what you hear, please rate us on iTunes and share the podcast through your social media channels. Help us extend the conversation. This is Getting to Yes And.
Working all day for a mean little man with a clip on tight and a rub on tan. He's got me running around the office like a dog around a track. But when I get back home, you're always there to rub my back.
My guest today on Getting the Yes And is Dan Ariely. Dan is the James B. Duke Professor of Psychology and Behavioral Economics at Duke University. He is the best-selling author of such books as Predictably Irrational, The Upside of Irrationality, The Honest Truth About Dishonesty, Irrationally Yours, and Dollars and Cents. Today, Dan's going to talk to us about the Medical Professionalism Project. It's a 12-episode, film-based, continuing medical education series that is aimed at improving medical ethics. The series is a product of the Center for Advanced Hindsight and the Dishonesty Project in collaboration with Duke Health. Dan Ariely, welcome to the show.
My pleasure. Good to be here.
So last year, I found myself on stage at Memorial Sloan Kettering in New York City with my Second City colleague, Kate James, and we're delivering an interactive keynote on improvisational practice and the ability to strengthen your focus and listening to better your collaboration and communication skills, and the overwhelming need to find healthy ways to incorporate inevitable failures into your personal and professional narrative, because that's what we do. And this last point around failure garnered a lot of conversation, and one of the executives at the hospital told me that 97% of the decisions made in healthcare organizations are not clinically related. And many of those decisions turn out to be mistakes. And he felt that their inability to recognize failure and admit mistakes was really hurting their ability to do their best work. And I feel like this new series that you're a part of really speaks to that issue.
We're trying. And if you think about the situation in the medical profession, we really put physicians in very, very tough situations. So there are things like breaking really bad news. So think to yourself, what was the worst news you ever had to break to somebody? Maybe a significant other that you decided to part ways with, or somebody you had to fire. And this is bad news, but it's not as bad as to telling somebody you're about to die. Mm-hmm. And you know, we don't prepare physicians for this. And actually, not too long ago, we accompanied physicians as they were breaking really bad news to patients. And after they broke the news, we talked to the patient separately. We talked to the physician separately. And we talked to the family separately. And it was as if they were not in the same room. And part of the problem, you know, when you're dating somebody, it's so tempting to say, it's not you, it's me. And, you know, you're hiding under all kinds of conditions. And physicians really have a very tough, right, very tough situation. But the project that we have is a bit more to help physicians understand the difficult situation that they're in and helping them make better decisions. And if you don't mind, I'll describe some of my own challenges with the healthcare system.
Yeah, please.
As a way to think about this. So I was a burn patient. I was badly burned when I was about 18, and I was in hospital for almost 3 years. Most of my body was covered with burns. Very tough injury, very long time to recover. Lots of stories changed my life in many ways. But the story I want to tell you now is that maybe 5 or 6 years after the injury, I'm already doing better. I'm a student. I'm in undergrad, and I come back for a checkup. And I come back for a checkup, and the head of the burn department calls me and said, Dan, I have a new fantastic treatment for you. Come to my office. I come to his office, and he explains to me that because my face is half burned, my right side of my face is burned, the left side is not. So on the right side, it's a bit more red and bright and shiny and covered with scars, and there's no hair. Mm-hmm. On the left side, I have stubble. And he says, look, this is non-symmetrical. Let's solve it. How does he propose to solve it? He said, let's tattoo the right side of your face. So on the left side of your face has little black dots, stubble. Let's make the right side of your face look the same. And I think to myself, you know, is this a good idea? And so on. And I say, do you have any pictures of other people you've done this to? And he shows me two faces. And it really looks very nice. It, mm-hmm. it looks like stubble. Mm-hmm. So he said, go home, wake up tomorrow, shave, come back to my office. By noon, you'll be symmetrical. Hmm. So I drive home and I think to myself, you know, what's the right shave? What should I aim for? Like the morning shave, the afternoon shadow? You know, it's a big decision. Right. You're going to be like that for a lifetime. So, you know, I make my decision. I get up a little extra early. I shave. I kind of figure out that, you know, by 10 a.m. I'll have the noon shave. Anyway, I get to his office and I say, you know what? I really don't think it's for me. I really don't think it's for me. And then he goes into this attack and he says, Dan, what's wrong with you? Hmm. He says, do you enjoy being non-symmetrical? Do you enjoy, you get some deprived pleasure from looking different? Do you get some benefit from looking non-normal? Now, this was kind of shocking because he was my physician for 3 years, and there were many treatments I took and some I rejected, and I never got this guilt trip. But anyway, I left his office. I didn't do the tattooing, and I went to his deputy and I said, what's going on here? And his deputy said, well, you know, we've done it for two patients already. I knew, I saw their pictures. Mm-hmm. And then he said that we needed a third patient for an academic paper. Right, so what is clear is that physician was in a conflict of interest. He wanted me as a third patient. Yeah. Now, here's the thing. When you think about this guy, he sounds like an awful person. But here's another story about the same person. So half of my eyebrow got burned, right? On the right side of my face, the right half of my eyebrow got burned. I didn't have it. And he really wanted to fix the right side of my right half. Eyebrow, and I couldn't care less. I had so many things wrong with me, mm-hmm. my legs, my hands, you know, so many things. Half an eyebrow was not high on my list, but he really was insisting and insisting and insisting. So finally I told him, I said, look, I'm going into a surgery for my right hand. If you want, come at the same time and fix the half an eyebrow. I'm not doing a special surgery mm-hmm. for half an eyebrow, but if it's in the same time, I'm fine with it. Anyway, he showed up when I was doing the surgery for my right hand, but they didn't have enough space. You know, the surgery takes really lots of space, lots of equipment, so he had to wait. He had to wait about 8 hours. Yeah. So let's say they start the surgery at noon. By 8 p.m., they were finished, and now he was going. And you might think that doing a half an eyebrow is a simple job, that you just pick some hair and transplant it. No, it's actually very complex. He shaved my head. He took a Doppler machine and tracked all the blood vessels on my scalp. He identified the blood vessels going up to a particular piece of skin, a blood vessel draining that particular piece. He isolated them and kind of took it out of my skull with the blood vessel leading in and blood vessel leading out, redirected it under my skin and pushed it out where my half an eyebrow was supposed to be. A really complex operation, took him the whole night. Now, this is Israel. I was injured in Israel. This was a part of, it's a socialized medicine, right? The guy doesn't make any money from mm-hmm. staying up late. The only thing he gets is to help me and maybe to satisfy his fetish for symmetry. but you know, if you think about this, if you think about the second story, he sounds like an amazing guy. Right. And he was an amazing guy. He was an amazing physician. And for me, that's the big issue, that it's not about being a good person or a bad person. It's about being a person in conflicts of interest. And when we have a conflict of interest, like you want an academic paper out, or you get more money if you put a stent in, or your group needs to accomplish some standards or whatever it is, all of a sudden it colors the way we view the world, and we're likely to see the world in ways that are good for us selfishly, but not really serving the purpose that we're supposed to.
Dan, I'm curious, were you at that point studying behavioral science, or did that come later?
So at that point, I was studying psychology at the university as an undergrad. So I didn't really think a lot about decision making, not yet.
Right.
At that point, I was mostly studying actually my... I went to psychology because I was in hospital for such a long time.
Sure.
And I was mostly interested in studying pain. So at that point, I was studying more physiology and pain.
Right.
So interested in the general topic, but I did not start studying conflicts of interest until Enron.
Yeah.
Actually started. And you know, Enron for me was a really interesting case. And again, I'll tell you how it happened. I was on a flight. And I look at one of these flight magazines, and there's a Mensa test, you know, these tests that ask you if you're really clever or not.
Yeah.
And, you know, and let's say the test is on page 77, and I read question one, and I think I know the answer, and he says the answers are on page 170. And I flip to page 170, and I look at the answer for question one, and I see that I got it. But I also realize that my eyes kind of wandered to the answer to question two. And then I go back to the original question, and I look at question two, and I say, oh, yes, of course, I know what it is. And I go back to page 170, and my eyes drift to question number three, and so on. And at the end of the process, I prove to myself that I'm indeed really bright. I solved all the problems.
Yes.
And, you know, and I realized I was cheating, and I was cheating myself. Like, you know, there was nobody else. There was no reason to do that. But I kind of wanted to prove to myself that I was a smart guy, and indeed I was successful in doing it. And it was really puzzling to me. Why would I want to prove something to myself? It was so strange. So I decided to do some experiments. And I started doing some experiments, not exactly with this paradigm, but I found that lots of people cheat a little bit and convince themselves very quickly that they were not cheating. Okay, so that was the finding. And then a couple of months later, Enron comes about. Mm. And when Enron comes about, the usual theory is, here's a case with three bad apples. But at that point, I finished testing like 2,000 people.
Right.
And in my sample, there were no bad apples. There were lots and lots of little cheaters.
Yeah.
From all the people I tested, there were no big cheaters. There were just little cheaters who were able to convince themselves that as long as they were cheating just a little bit, they were still good people. And this contrast between what we thought was the cause for cheating, bad apples, and what I was finding was incredibly important. Because, you see, if you think that we understand exactly when we cheat and when we don't cheat, that we do it fully consciously and that are indeed bad apples, that says, you know, let's just fix HR. Let's just figure out a way to hire good apples and not hire bad apples. But if you think that the real issue is conflicts of interest and that you can hire anybody you want, Mother Teresa, and if you put them in a situation of conflicts of interest, they're going to see life from a different angle, then you have a very different process. And then hiring good people is not going to protect you, and actually eliminating conflicts of interest is incredibly important. And indeed, this is the case. And sadly, this is such an important lesson, but we really haven't kind of internalized it. So if you think about the financial world, you think about Wall Street, you think about health, you think about politics, you think about all kinds of places where conflicts of interest is prevailing and not really going down in power, it's incredibly distressing.
It's interesting too, because you have measured dishonesty, right? I mean, that's you found a way to do that. And what I found fascinating about it, and what you're referring to is I certainly didn't know until I was looking at your work that there's all these different ways that we are dishonest in bigger or smaller ways, just every human being. And I felt like the experiment at Carnegie Mellon was actually really unique, because you actually hired an actor to participate in the experiment.
Yeah, so we've done lots of experiments, and we've done all kinds of paradigms, all kind of methods to measure dishonesty, but I'll tell you one of them. It's not the one we used in that experiment, but but it will give you a general sense. So we give people a die, a six-sided die, and we say, why don't you toss the die, and we'll pay you whatever it comes up on. It will come on six, we'll pay you $6, $5, $5, $4, $4, and so on and so forth. But you can get paid based on the top side or the bottom. The top or the bottom, you decide, but don't tell us. So what happened? You're in the experiment, and we say top or bottom. Think, you know what you want. Please remember it. You remember it, and now we say, and now toss the die. So you first think to yourself what you want, top or bottom, and now you toss the die. And let's say that the die came with five on the bottom and two on the top. Now, if you chose bottom, no problem. You say bottom and you get $5. But if you thought top, you have a dilemma. Do you say the truth, top, and get only $2? Or do you change your mind after the fact, say bottom, and get $5? And in our experiments, people do this 20 times. Every time they think top or bottom, committed to memory, toss the die, write down on a piece of paper the die came, five on the bottom, two on the top, six on the bottom, one on the top, and so on. Mm-hmm. And then they say what they picked. And when people do it 20 times, you find that people are incredibly lucky. Basically people cheat. And nobody is lucky the whole way. Nobody gets 20 out of 20, but people, you know, get 13 out of 20, right? You would expect people to get 10 out of 20 on average, but the average is higher than you expected. And really, in a nice way, luck is very kind to us, because the cases where people are extra lucky are the cases where it's usually 6-1 or 5-2, not so much on the 3-4 tosses. Okay, so lots of people cheat a little bit. Another question is, what gets people to cheat more and what gets people to cheat less? And it turns out it's not about fear of being caught. It's not about how much money you can gain. It's about all kinds of ways to justify what we do. It's all kinds of ways to rationalize what we do. So what we have is these conflicts of interest, the desire to see the world through our perspective, right? The desire to say, oh, yes, I really meant top, I really meant bottom. And now the question is, what justifies it? So here's an experiment. You do this experiment, right? You toss the die 20 times and you write it down. And one time you do it by yourself, and another time you do it when your significant other is sitting next to you. Now, your significant other doesn't know what's in your mind, top or bottom, but they see whether you're extra lucky or not. So what do you think? Do people cheat more or less the same when the significant other sits next to them?
I would think they cheat less.
You would think so, but they actually cheat more.
Oh, no.
Now, why do they cheat more? Let me take you to another experiment, and we'll come back to this. In another experiment, people do the same task, but we connect them to a lie detector. And what happens with the lie detector? It turns out the lie detector can detect cheating. That's good news. But in another version of the experiment, we connect people to a lie detector, but we say all the money you make today is not going to go to you. It's going to go to a charity of your choice, your favorite charity. Pick your favorite charity. All the money will go to that. So first question, do people cheat more or less or the same when the money goes to charity?
Well, now I think they cheat more.
They do cheat more.
Yeah.
And more interestingly, the lie detector stops working. Now, why doesn't the lie detector work? You see, the way that lie detector work is they detect attention.
Yeah.
You feel bad. You say, I want more money, but it's wrong. I want more money, but it's wrong. Now, what happens if the money goes to charity? You don't feel wrong about it.
Right.
Right? Think about Robin Hood. Do you think Robin Hood felt bad? Robbing the rich? No, he probably felt bad when he was not robbing the rich. Right? Now, what happens? Let's go back to our experiment. What happens when you sit next to your significant other? All of a sudden, you don't just cheat for yourself. You cheat for the whole family. Right? And yep. Now people feel more justified. And by the way, it's true also when people cheat for a team or a group at work or people that they like, it basically liberates us a little bit more from our moral shackles. Now, here's the other experiment that you mentioned with Carnegie Mellon. So we do this experiment, and people sit in a room, and this experiment was slightly different, but we made it clear that the first person in that room, that one person, was cheating in a really big way, mm-hmm. right? That person says, I got everything correctly, right? Mm-hmm. Or somebody cheats in a big way. What happens when somebody cheats in a big way? And the experimenter said, oh, you solved everything correctly. Take all the money and go home. And they take all the money and go home. And you are there in the room, and you see that somebody cheats in an egregious way, clearly cheats. Nobody can get everything correctly. And they go home with all the money. What happens? Lots more people cheat. But you can have two interpretations here. One interpretation could be, oh, in this experiment, you can cheat and get away with it. Nobody catches you. Let's do that as well. Another interpretation could be, this is actually morally okay. It's not about the probability of being caught. It's about reframing what is right and what is wrong. So to test this, we changed the social identity of the cheater. This experiment was conducted in Carnegie Mellon. Everybody was a Carnegie Mellon student. The acting student that, you know, said I solved everything was a Carnegie Mellon student. Mm-hmm. But in another condition, we gave him a Pittsburgh University sweatshirt. So now that person was cheating just the same way, right? It mm-hmm. was clear in the same way that you can cheat and get away with it. But what was different? He wasn't a part of your in-group. So he wasn't, in his action, wasn't saying people like us cheat. And what happened now? Now cheating went down. Hmm. Now basically what happened is people said, oh, cheating is possible here. And it's these other people from these other universities we don't like so much. Those are the people who are cheating, and they cheated actually actually less. So the lesson here is that a lot of what we do has to do with what we find is socially acceptable. What are people around us doing? What are people around us finding that is okay and not okay to do? And the morality of our environment really, really matters. Now, this, of course, takes us to the question of what do we expect from people in an environment where they see, for example, politicians mm-hmm. being slightly less than honest, right? How does that change our understanding of what's right and what's wrong, what is acceptable and not? And of course, it does have a large effect on our own understanding of what's the right behavior.
Right. I'm curious too. So this seems connected to you talk about distance, right, as part of this. And in comedy theory, we talk a lot about distance because the idea is you can make jokes about very serious matters given how much distance you or the audience have in relation to the thing you're joking about. And the more distance, the more edge you play with, and the less distance, yep. the greater chance that a joke's going to hurt or offend someone. So that's very true in my field. And then
that's right. And yeah. I also think that in comedy, it's the distance can come from time. Yep. For example, if something just happened recently, mm-hmm. it's probably too soon
yep.
To joke about in an aggressive way, right? So mm-hmm. time creates distance. And, of course, physical distance,
yep.
probably easier to joke about things that are on the other side of the country.
Yep.
And social distance.
Yep, right.
Other groups are much easier to laugh at.
Yeah, and I'm curious about too in a medical setting, because then so what it seems to be is that if you can shorten the distance and get people closer, they have a less of a chance to be unethical or misbehave. And I'm wondering if there is research at all around the idea of patients creating less distance between themselves and the medical professionals. I mean, I'm literally in this situation. One of the things I was going to mention too is I'm very interested in behavioral science. I work with the group up at the Center for Decision Research on a thing called the Second Science Project, which is about how we look at behavioral science through the lens of improvisation. And I've developed an Improv for Caregivers program that we recently launched. But more importantly, my daughter got diagnosed with cancer just the end of the summer. And so I've literally spent the last like 60 days in a hospital interacting with medical professionals and having, you know, sort of on an amateur level, been looking at the behavioral science work and also the caregiving stuff. What I've realized that in situations where I'm filling more and more personal detail and the nurses know who I am, I don't want to say we get greater care, but it feels like our care is heightened or more attentive.
Yeah. So there's actually a very wonderful piece of research that shows that where people in radiology, mm-hmm. you know, right, they get x-rays, and they got an x-ray together with a picture of the patient, they actually made less errors.
Wow.
Right? So you know, you look at an x-ray and you say, is this a real person? And of course, you know, these are physicians. They know it's a real person.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, it doesn't feel like a real person. And when you see their face, you know, through the x-ray, and you see their picture, you care more. Right? And all of a sudden, you spend a bit more time and becoming a bit more caring. So this question about distance, I think, is very, very important. Right? So imagine, think about something like a moral dilemma. I'm sure you know the trolley problem, right?
Oh, yeah. Yep.
Yeah. So the classical problem. You stand by a train. The train comes. If it continues in its path, mm-hmm. it would run over five people who are kind of fixing the track. But you have a lever, and if you pull the lever, it will change to a sidetrack. And there's one person on that sidetrack, and it will kill one instead of five. And most people say, of course, pull the lever. Yeah. What's the question? You know, it will be one versus five. Case number two, you're standing on the bridge. The train is coming underneath the bridge. If it will continue, it will kill five people. There's no lever, there's no sidetrack, but there's a person next to you with a big backpack. And you know for sure that if you push that person down, he will fall on the track just before the train, and the train would run him down and stop and save and save the five people. And you say to the people, you know, do you push that guy?
Mm-hmm.
And people think it's horrific.
Sure.
To push the guy. And in brain imaging studies, what they show is that in the first case, it's a cognitive decision, one versus five. The second case is an emotional decision, right? Looking somebody in the eyes who is standing next to you and pushing them to their death feels very different, even though, you know, it's the same as pulling the lever. So what gets us to care are incredibly small nuances. So imagine a physician who gets to make much more money if somebody gets a stent.
Yeah.
And let's say that the stent is not so good for the patient, but good for the doctor. Right? Now, I'm not saying physicians. Like, if you think about our research, we don't show that physicians are cruel or, you know, do things intentionally. But in the same way that a sports fan is going to be biased to see the world through the perspective of their team,
right?
Right. That if you like a particular sports group and the referee calls a call against your team, you have to think the referee is evil, vile, stupid, something
mm-hmm.
Like that. And if you're a physician and you get to make more money from putting in stents than other things, then you know, of course, you're going to see life from this perspective. And when the distance increases, it's even easier to act on these impulses. By the way, do you know that in some cases when people install all kinds of medical devices, like let's say a hip replacement or something like that,
mm-hmm.
the salespeople for the company that sells the hip replacement are likely to be in the operating room selling the physician in real time the
hip? Wow.
Yeah. So you go into a hip replacement, and the hospital says, you know, we don't know what hips people want. They change them all the time. There are lots of models and so on. So we will create a closet for the company that sells hip replacements. And the salesperson could be there in the operating room. And in real time, they'll open the patient up and then have a discussion about what's the right hip to give to that patient. Do you really want to be in that situation
no.
where somebody is selling your physician
wow.
a hip? And that person, by the way, that salesperson never met you.
Right.
They don't care about you. And they get a commission for the more expensive hips.
Yeah.
Right? Terrible situation.
How would you
even imagine that somebody will design something
right.
like this?
No, it's the worst.
It's crazy.
Yeah. It's so interesting because we know lots of businesses have embraced behavioral science and realized this, and you're making this really wonderful program for the medical community. And it seems to all about, like, we finally sort of recognize that, oh, wait, business, we've made an artificial construct. These are actually just human beings being human beings. And so if we understand how, generally speaking, how human beings act or make decisions, that's going to be very helpful. And up until now, it sort of boggles the mind why those things are separate, right? That we make all these wonderful discoveries. And I'm curious, in terms of this particular program at Duke, who sought each other out? Did they sort of pick up on maybe this would be good? Is this something that your team kind of went in and said, have you considered this?
So it was really a combination. So we had this movie on this honesty that Yael Melamed directed and produced, and I appeared in, and some of the research that we did was part of it. And when the movie came out, it came out in some movie theaters and in some movie festivals, but the medical school here asked us to screen it. So we screened it in the medical school, and then I had a tremendous amount of interest from people. And what was so interesting is that it was helpful for people to see other people's dishonesty, to reflect on their own challenges. Right? So all of a sudden, physician would say, oh, there was this guy in the movie who was a cyclist, and basically took a small step in the wrong direction, and then it was easier for him to take the next one.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering whether this is something that is also happens to us.
Right.
So it was kind of an outside look on dishonesty in a very non-judgmental way, because the movie is not about the movie on the research is not about blaming people. It's so easy to blame people.
Yeah.
But the real villain is human nature.
Sure.
Right, so you say, we can point fingers and say this is a bad person, this is a bad person, and of course, from time to time, there are bad people, but mostly it's just human nature, and the fact that we build a society that has so much conflicts of interest, right? In the same way that we spend so much time improving donuts, and then we get surprised that people are obese, we shouldn't be surprised if we create so much conflicts of interest, and we find that people fail,
right?
So the movie was kind of a mirror for that. And then at the request of people in the medical school, they wanted us to do something that is a bit more tailored to their particular challenges,
mm-hmm.
right? So conflicts of interest are the same. But there's some things that are, like the principles are the same. Physicians don't have a different brain just because they become physicians. They don't have necessarily different biases. But the way they play out and the things to worry about and to be cautious about are slightly different. So we created that program.
Yeah, it's really cool. And I went through the whole course, and you of course have segments from the documentary and lots of interviews with different physicians and medical personnel, many of whom tell their own stories of making mistakes and errors, which again is a very powerful thing. And then there's also quizzes and sort of it taps into all the different ways that we learn. And it's funny too. There's you've got some really engaging stories. I could talk to you.
I think is important to say is,
please.
There's some like efforts to do things like compliance.
Yeah.
And write down lots of rules. But the reality is that ethics is more like a diet than like reading a book of compliance. Mm-hmm. Ethics is something we have to deal with all the time. It's not going to go away. And just knowing the rules is no guarantee. In the same way that knowing that texting and driving is dangerous doesn't stop people from texting and driving,
right.
having a list of rules for compliance doesn't stop us from doing it. And new things come up all the time. And just knowing the rules of compliance is not going to help us. But what we need to do is we need to have it at the top of our mind as an important principle. And we need to identify the places that we're likely to fail and pay extra attention when we get close to those. So, and this is why also the program is a year-long program. We want people to keep on thinking about this.
Yeah.
Not just, you know, take a course and it's over, but we really want people to continue thinking, debating, examining, and so on. This is the only way to really improve things.
Yeah, well, I mean, and this is paramount to our work because in improvisation, it's almost an ethical construct, right? So you have to make your partner look good. You have to say yes and. You have to focus on their needs. And just like the idea of yes and is, you don't have to – I'm not telling you to believe it. I'm just saying you have to do it. But what we find is you do it enough times, you start to – the mindset starts to change. And it's also – it's a very pro-social act. And there's just sort of these boundaries that exist which are all about behaving well in groups. And the practice of it is how you become better at it. It's not like the analogy you used is great, but it's like going to the gym once. You're not done. You have to keep doing it. All right, so we're running out of time, and I do want to have you see if you can scrounge up a yes and story for us. And in the concept of improvisation, when groups of people are making something out of nothing, we have found that you can't do that by saying no, and you can't simply do that by just saying yes. You have to say yes and. You have to affirm and contribute in order to explore and heighten. And I'm wondering if you have a yes and story from your work or your life.
So I'll tell you a... I'm not sure it's a yes and story, but I'll tell
Go
you this
it.
Story, and you'll tell me if it's a yes and story. So I get lots of calls from people who want to meet me. So at some point, I have a flight. I'm landing in San Francisco at close to midnight. So this guy wants to meet me. So I say, okay, I'll meet you if you'll pick me up from the airport around midnight and take me to Palo Alto. It's about a half an hour drive.
Yep.
And I say, and you'll have half an hour to pitch me on your idea. So he picks me up and he has half an hour to pitch me on his idea. And the guy is just lovely. So the next day I spend 3 hours writing up things for him and trying to help him define his idea from a behavioral economics perspective. And it's now 4 years later. I still think he's a great guy, and now we have a startup together.
That is absolutely the essence of yes and. So no, you nailed it. Dan Ariely, thank you for coming on the show.
My pleasure. Lovely talking to you.
Yeah.